Football is life. Welcome back to the Incomparables podcast, all about Ted Lasso. This is the season finale of Ted Lasso, season 2, episode 12, Inverting the Pyramid of Success. I'm Jason Snell. It's not our season finale, though, but more on that in a little bit. You know what? I love our chats. Let's have another one. Here are my guests, James Thompson. Hello.
I've got some bad news about your childhood home.
That's okay. We're having the carpets replaced. Casey Liss is here. Hello.
You know, Jason, I'm a little scared that when you're done, I won't have any teeth left, and I'm going to need that for the talking parts.
Kathy Campbell is here. Hello.
Hello, London's premier all-female dog breeder, Kathy Campbell. Huge fan. Huge fan.
Huge fan. And Jean McDonald is here. Hi.
Hi. So we're just chatting about stuff, but nobody has to solve anything, and nothing changes again.
Yeah. yeah, we're still here. I mean, still, like, it remains, we remain here.
Nicely done.
This is, so big finale. It's the big finish, everybody, of this season. And there's a lot to talk about. I'm gonna do the classic walk through the plot because there is too much. I'm just going to throw out what happens and we can talk about it as we go. We begin with the soccer special. It's our TV talking heads minus Roy, which allows us to have the former manager of Richmond do the standard, I would say, sports reaction. In fact, anybody who was paying attention to the Olympics this summer got to see this too, which is the was this famous person having panic attacks? Was this famous person having panic attacks? Well, then Ted Lasso was clearly not qualified to be a coach because he had a panic attack. By the way, some of those people probably did have panic attacks; they just didn't write about it. But anyway, so we get our kind of like conventional wisdom about Ted, which then heads to we head to Ted, where he gets a supportive text from Rebecca. He gets a voicemail from Sharon. He gets a text from his ex-wife, who he has a nice exchange with, where he does a little knock-knock joke, and she says, obviously, you're fine. And then he asks why she's up so late, essentially. And she in one of the best uses of the three dots from iMessage that appears and then stops, he realizes, oh, it's none of my beeswax, as he says, thank you for reaching out. And that's the beginning here. We get a lot of that of Ted. There's also that scene shortly where Ted is walking on the streets and it's like, you know, people are looking at him because some personal thing about him has been revealed and they are judging him differently because of it.
We need to actually back up to almost the very first line in the episode, which I only caught on a rewatch that I did a couple of hours ago. The lead-in to the sports commentators, they make a throwaway comment about how there's rumors of change
at West Ham. Yes, it will.
Which
it will.
I did not catch the first time, nope. And that will come back in a little while.
Yes, watch out, Hams. We're keeping our eye on you out there in the West, you westerly Hams.
I did think in that also that the sort of the use, the very British phrase, big girl's blouse, to kind of insinuate that mental health problems are in some way effeminate for a man like Ted to have. And yeah, that's an expression that definitely if you grew up in the playgrounds of the UK, you would have heard.
Yeah, I mean, that guy is our representation of terribleness, right? He has been from episode one of season one. He is sort of conventional sports masculinity and also conventional thought, conventional wisdom. He is a good, I mean, for a show that practices empathy, you know, there's not a lot of empathy for this guy. He is more just that representation of all of the conventional awfulness in the world, really.
Yes. He is exactly what public persona is, encapsulated in this audio version of him, you know, saying what everyone's thinking. And the reactions were great in the other talking heads to him. And yeah, I wish they had gone a little bit further because obviously they couldn't completely call him out and be like, what the fuck? But
one of the interesting things there is that he is the fictional character.
Right.
And the other two are actually real people. So they probably didn't want to be saying terrible things on camera.
True. Also, James, I think they're all real people. Roy comes back in the future, and he's the CGI character.
Yeah, that's right. How can we forget? I also wanted to quickly take note that this might be the only time that I thought an audio message sent via iMessage actually kind of made sense in the history of mankind. That was the only time I think it made sense. So,
and it worked. Actually went. You didn't have to try and figure out how to play mm-hmm. it. It just kind of worked. Yeah. Raised to
Very
listen.
Impressive. Yeah, but
also in the conversation
Michelle doesn't have read receipts turned on because mm-hmm. she this is we're just listen to the Apple Nerdery segment. She did a tap back to Ted with the status of the message still being delivered and not read. Yep. So I don't know what's going on there. We'll have to check out Michelle's settings later.
There was no iMessage history.
Right.
Yeah.
There was no back conversation at all. So Ted had deleted
their iMessage history. Sure.
Which makes sense because I'm sure it would be emotional.
So any thoughts about the Ted walks around and there's the people, there's one guy who says, you know, the Germans would be in charge if my grandfather had gotten a panic attack at Normandy, which is, I mean, and Ted agrees with him. And then he turns around and says, you know, you'll be okay. Right. It's like he pivots in that moment. And I think that there's a lot to be said there about our views of mental illness. Also, because panic attacks panic attack at Normandy. It's like, well, that's not really, I mean, yes, everybody's scared at Normandy. This is a little bit different. There's a misunderstanding there, but I also appreciate the kind of change when Ted reacts to that the guy tries to give him a little bit of a pep talk as he walks away. And then of course Beard is just sitting there and he's like, no, I don't know what's going on. I don't know.
I thought all the tabloid headlines were pretty good representations of the pun laden headlines that you would get in the real British tabloids.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The layouts were all very authentic, I thought, for newspapers. That's not something TV does well usually, but they did a good job with it.
I also felt a strong throwback to the beginning of the first season when it felt very similar to when he's walking through town and everyone is paying attention to him. They know what's going on. And he has that same sort of, well, what you gonna do? You know, I'm going to give you space to say what you think, even if I think you are incorrect. But I'm still going to be the kind Ted we all know and love.
At the office, Akufu has sent sorry for your loss flowers for stealing Sam. Seems a little premature. Higgins has a cool nod. And Ted walks in to say, you know, what they say, there's no such thing as bad publicity. I think they might have been wrong about that. Which is a great moment. And I think Keeley calls Trent Crim a dick. And he's like, nah, he's just doing his job, which is something that's going to come back later. Yep. Ted is bringing Rebecca biscuits. And I thought, really? After the night Ted has had, he made biscuits for Rebecca. And then immediately she bites into it and he goes, well, so I guess, and I have done this too, which is like, did I use the wrong ingredient? And he's like, I guess I did use salt instead of sugar in those. And
But she keeps eating them. Yeah. Despite them being terrible.
That was weird.
Well, and I thought it was like actually a bit of a, like, you know what? Because she then was like, you know, like we put salt in things all the time now, right? So I thought she was like thinking, wait, maybe this is a whole new flavor.
Yeah.
And it's really the sneaky salty bee.
Yeah.
You know, I thought
the bee is for biscuit.
That's, yes.
Yeah. Or a boss, one of the.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I had to look that up later. I thought this is so Ted Lasso to like take a thing and like say maybe it's not so bad after all.
Also, we get let's see, in this section, Sam gets a box in his locker from Akufu, who he's given him number 10. I don't know the significance of that.
I was going to ask if anyone knew a significance.
No, I didn't figure that out. I didn't try to.
I don't know if it actually has a reason so much as Akufu is just assuming that Sam is going to play for him and is like, hey, I'm making these decisions for you. You don't get to choose your number. We're going to make sure that it's a different number than you're playing with Richmond. This is just your number.
Right. I that was the best I could come up with, is short of being a reference to something in the real world or in the Ted Lasso world, it's at the very least, it's Akufu basically taking complete control of the situation and even choosing his number for him. Like, that's a compliment, and maybe he could listen to Sam about it, but he doesn't. He just assigns him a new number. And a lot, Khufu, I mean, I guess you're a billionaire, you get access, but like his helicopter's still parked on the training grounds and he's right. he's going around and he has access to the locker room and all this stuff. Like, it's a little weird.
He's going to tell him no.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess that's so. So, Jamie is looking for Roy. So is Nate.
Junior grunting.
Beard, who is very clearly, you know, been fed up with Nate for a while now, says, "You seen this?" And that's the Independent with that story. And he's like, it was awful. Yeah, it was awful. By the way, some real-time follow-up from Casey List. Number 10, was Pele? Was Pele's number all-time great? Is he just trying to say that Sam is going to be the all-time great like Pele was? I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, who knows? I just looked it up while you guys were talking. I didn't want to interrupt.
Famous
the
soccer
here,
number 10s. Sure.
But yeah, I mean, my first guess was, well, who would I know as a non-soccer fan, as somebody who is famous and extremely skilled? And I thought, well, what did Pele have? And sure enough, he was number 10. So I don't know if that was a deliberate callback or not, but that's the best I can come up with.
It seems like.
I think Maradona was also number 10. So 10 is like the superstar number. Maybe that's it.
Gotcha.
We know lots about soccer.
Yes.
So back to Nate and Beard. I've always liked Beard. I have mixed feelings about the Beard episode, but leaving that aside, I like Beard as a character. And I thought that it's Brendan Hunt, right? I have that right. I thought his performance, particularly in this episode, was excellent. It was extremely understated, but extremely effective as well. And I just thought he completely, you know, rode that line in the best possible way of not being too over the top, but still really hammering the point of his thoughts and feelings home. And I thought this was a great example. Like, yes, it was awful, wasn't it? You know? Or whatever. Yeah. It was really, really well done.
Also, in that scene, at the start, he's rereading his annotated copy of Inverting the Pyramid, which is what he was reading on the flight over at the start of season one. And
I love it.
And it's clearly got all the little markers
little
and stuff.
Little text.
In
yes. I think this episode might be. Beard is one of my top three favorite characters. Don't ask me what the other two are because they're all the favorites. But this episode specifically really showcased Beard even more than the All Beard episode.
Yes, like, I agree.
Who he is as a person, who he is as a character, and his like manner of being so supportive in a way that's also full of boundaries. Like, I want to headbutt Nate, but I'm not going to because that's Ted's space, but I'm going to make it as uncomfortable as I can for him because this was not okay, but still giving Ted the space to be managing all of that.
Horticulture, baby.
Yeah.
Yes, Beard. A lot of subtle Beard, plus also not subtle Beard in this episode. So I wanted to get something. Obviously, we have to talk a lot about Nate, everything in this about Nate and the whole Nate storyline and all of that. But I want to point out something that happens here because I do think it is emblematic of how the show is not shying away from the fact that, well, that it's complicated, that Nate has a lot of issues and has read all sorts of things really wrong because of who Nate is, and that Nate's behavior is not, I would say, excusable, but it's understandable. And this is a good example of that, which is Jamie's been looking for Roy, Nate is looking for Roy. Roy shows up, he blows right past Nate, is told that Jamie is looking for him and goes and sees Jamie. Even though Nate is like, oh, Roy, he blows right past him. And like, this is not the first time that Nate has not really been taken seriously especially by Roy, but by a lot of people. And I feel like this is the show playing fair with the idea that it's not as if everybody's been nice to Nate the whole time. That there are things that have happened that Nate could use to internalize his own little sort of thing, his own little storyline that he's invented for himself, that he's built up, that shows how nobody respects him. But it's not all coming from a place of the imagination, right? Like, there are real sort of lacks of respect and transgressions and things that are small and not intended the way that he interprets it, but they are there and they've been there throughout the season. And this, I thought, was a very good almost final example of these transgressions toward toward Nate. So I like that it played fair. Like, again, I not defending Nate so much as to say I understand how I think the show showed how he got to where he did.
Yeah, I don't think anyone who thinks it came out of nowhere, it was not paying attention. And obviously, I thought it came out of nowhere. And then rewatching and thinking about it and recognizing the microaggressions and the low-key events that were happening, you see it without a doubt. And it's not as much of a surprise now that you know that the season is over. And so I'm really excited to finish watching the whole series. I've watched the first six episodes again with a friend who it's their first watch. And it was like just mind-blowing the pieces that they've laid mm-hmm. down for the transition for Nate from the very first episode. And it's just so well done.
There's a moment earlier this season, I believe, where Nate offers to go. I don't even remember what the detail is. Offers
it's
to go
talk to Isaac about Isaac's problems. And,
right.
And we need a big dog captain. For that.
Yeah. And it's kind of laughed off. And in that moment, it is simultaneously accurate. Nate is not the right person to do that. But also, it's a blow to Nate. And the people who are involved are not aware of what a blow it is to Nate. And I feel like that was one of the most accurate and honest portrayals of something like this that you will find, which is, mm-hmm. you know, nice people who are intending to do the right thing will sometimes do things that are not intended to be mean, but are a little bit mean. And more than that, you know, it's going to stick with the person. And I think that previous example with Nate is a good example of that. That you know, they're not trying to run him down. He's just the wrong person for that role, and he sort of overstepped by suggesting it. But it's totally right and understandable that he would be hurt by that moment, and he is.
I think, though, if you go back, even to, like, the scene where he's roasting the players towards the end of season one, and you can see that meanness, that kind of, like, it was funny at the time because you had this kind of, like, quite meek character, like, stepping into this role and actually doing this effective roast of everyone.
Yep.
But rewatching that scene again, it's like, oh, no, he has had this inside him since, like, the start of the show.
Yeah.
And it's just he has the opportunity to be mean to more people, I think, as time goes on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's so true. And it's so fascinating. I very desperately want to rewatch really the whole run of the show, but particularly this last season when we're seeing this heel turn happen more and more quickly, because I feel like I can Zapruder like the whole darn thing and see things that I just hadn't noticed before. And the roast is an exceptional example of that. And the other thing that was striking about this particular scene when, you know, Roy comes into the office is that when we first see Nate in this scene, I remember thinking to myself, wow, he got gray.
Yes.
And of course, that's deliberate. And even at the time, I thought, wow, that must be deliberate. He must be stressed out. But it was probably something that I assume has been happening all season, and
yes.
I just hadn't noticed.
Yeah, it has. Yep.
Nick Mohammed has some gray hair. They dyed it out. They colored it out, and then added the gray back in across the whole season. And then, according to the interview that was posted a couple of days ago, the last scene of this episode, it's a full on wig, but he does have some grays, and they did keep adding it throughout the season. Also, Nick Mohammed pointed out in that same article, the very first time we meet Nate, he is yelling at Ted and Beard.
Yeah.
So, like, this is not they've constructed this character carefully to be. I mean, that's why he's so real. I feel like he's got all of these issues kind of rolled up, and he wants attention, and he wants to be validated. And in season one, he is validated. And when he arrives, he wants to keep being validated, and that's a problem, right? Because at some point you need to become more self-confident, and you need to realize that you don't need to have constant validation, and that doesn't happen with Nate. And as a manager, I have to say, as somebody who has managed people for a long time, and I don't anymore, but for a long time, I will tell you, this is the hardest thing I always found, was was some people, you give them responsibilities and you trust them. And you're like, you're doing a great job. You know, I'm going to let you do your job and I'm not going to bug you. And other people, if you do that, they feel like they've abandoned you or they feel like you've abandoned them. Even if you trust them, they don't know and they can't. Like, it's a really hard thing. And I very much recognized it in Nate.
I think, though, like, we're giving him a certain amount of an out because he's got... Well, A, yes, he's been horrible to people for the whole thing, but it's also he's got this like big streak of self-loathing that seems to be powering all this.
Sure.
And it's unclear.
That's why he spits at himself in the mirror.
Exactly. And I think there's the scene where later on where Roy kind of just doesn't even see him as a threat when he confesses the thing about the...
about kissing Keely.
Kissing Keely. And I think that just adds even more to his self-loathing because he can't even be bad well.
Right. He can't.
Or he's not taken seriously as, you know, some kind of threat or some kind of offense to Roy as a boyfriend because it's Nate.
Or that other people don't see him the way he sees himself is another way to do it, right? Like he has these moments of like, well, look, I'm confident. I'll go talk to Isaac, and they're like, no, that's not a thing that's going to happen. Or I should be a threat to Roy, and Roy's response is, no, you're not. No. But I think if anybody wants to come to Nate's defense and say he's actually right, that's a take. I'd be interested in that. But, what I like about this portrayal is that I understand, I feel like the show is played fair in the sense that I understand all the things that are feeding what he's doing. It's messed up. And the speech that he gives later on in this episode, there was a listener on a Slack that I'm on who was really mad at the show and thought that speech was ridiculous. And I had to say, sort of as an aside, I was like, I think you're mad at Nate. Like, that speech, we're all meant to look at that speech and be like, come on, man. Like, there's truth in it, though. That's the beauty of it, is it's based on some things that are real, but the interpretations are so messed up. And, you know, I don't know, that feels real to me, that somebody who is on this path of self-destruction, who has all of these personal issues and wants to seek validation but also has self-loathing, it feels right to me that all of these positive inputs would end up having this negative effect. The fact that he accuses Ted of not being qualified to do his job and that Nate really takes all the credit for everything that's been successful when Nate would have just been washing clothes if it weren't for Ted is like the perfect example of his delusion here, that he ascribes all negative things to Ted and all positive things to himself.
And the fact that Ted didn't jump in, like when he's like, I got you this really sweet photo and all you have is some dumb Americans on your desk. And instead of saying, well, yeah, because I put it at home next to my son.
That's the tragedy of it, right?
It's heartbreaking, is these moments that Ted is just like, whoa, I don't know how to react to this necessarily, other than, you know, validate your feelings, because clearly Nate was not in a place where he was going to listen to anything that Ted said. And that had to have been, like, as a character's side of things, that has to be like the hardest thing to do, is to not correct someone that you know is wrong, whether they're on the internet or in real life.
It's so true. And, you know, I also want to call out, like, Nick Mohammed's performance throughout this entire show, but particularly this season, I think is phenomenal, because I can tell you, I viscerally hate Nate. Like, I hate him so much.
Yes.
And I feel like the reason I'm having such a strong visceral reaction to that character is because of the performance, and the writing as well, of course, but the performance is so good and so nuanced, much like with Beard, and so subtle, and I hate Nate so much. And when I... first watched through the whole season, I've only seen it once now, but as I'm watching through the season, I felt like, and I know this isn't the recap show, so I'll try to make this quick, but the season was taking something that I reflect upon as being a happy-go-lucky, like, jaunt through, you know, daffodils, and taking it and making it not so happy and not so lucky. And I think that's an unfair interpretation of season one on my part. And I think that now that I see where we've ended season two, I'm starting to realize that what I thought I was eating was like a a really simple, not like a mozzarella stick appetizer. And I'm getting in the meal I got was actually quite a bit more interesting and had quite a bit more depth than I expected. And that's not necessarily bad, but it certainly wasn't what I had expected when I sat down at the dinner table to beat this analogy to death. And I'm really enjoying letting this sit with me for a little while. And we're all, you know, I only watched it for the first time a day ago, but over the next couple of weeks, I want to let this kind of just marinate for a while and then come back to the season and watch it again and see how I perceive it. Because my initial reaction of this season's run was that I really didn't care for it that much, but I think I will take a very different perspective on it now that it's all over watching it again.
Mm-hmm. I think they were referring to this season as, you know, the dark middle chapter Empire Strikes Back style thing. So where it went didn't really surprise me at all, because I was expecting exactly what happened, in that, you know, they win the football, to invert the previous season. They win the football, mm-hmm. but all the relationships are in tatters. And in fact, there was actually less relationship damage by the end of the season than I thought we were going to get.
Yes.
But yeah, this season was kind of like about turning everything from the previous season on its head. And then I think, you know, we're going to get a slightly happier, I hope, third season.
Yeah. So back to the plot. Roy does talk to Jamie, and Jamie sincerely apologizes for what he said to Keeley at the church, which makes Roy very angry because he can't, like, punch Jamie. He has to be an adult and accept an apology instead. So there's an implication in the script, because there's also that scene later where Keeley says, "I didn't put him up to it," that it's possible that Jamie and Keeley have had a conversation beyond the one at the church. It's possible that they haven't. But I'm going to just flag this here. I'm a little bit uncomfortable with the Jamie says something to Keeley, but he apologizes to Roy.
Mm-hmm.
Because although, yes, they are in a monogamous relationship and therefore they work together, and so there is a social contract that's been broken and all of that, the truth is that she's not his property. And
right.
That the only person he should be apologizing to is Keeley, not to Roy. And if he's apologizing to Roy, what he really should be doing is acknowledging that it was inappropriate for him to say that to Keeley, not that it's inappropriate that he transgressed some sort of man code.
Bro code, yeah.
And I, you know, I let it go because these are soccer players, and I think that it's okay to say that this is Jamie is a work in progress. But you know, I'm a little disappointed that the show sort of goes with that idea that Jamie owes Roy an apology for talking to his girlfriend, because I don't think that's how that should work.
Especially because they didn't show anything else with Jamie and Keeley. And I think that they should have had that same apology with Jamie and Keeley, because Jamie owes Keeley an apology for having her in this, like, situation of having to balance and, like...
If he owes anyone an apology, I think you could argue he doesn't owe anyone an apology, because all he was doing was being honest, and that's all he was doing. But if he owes anyone an apology, it's presumably Keeley for what he said, and not Roy for speaking to his girlfriend.
His property. Yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting, because I was impressed with the apology. First
oh,
of
yes.
all. Like, I was like, whoa, this is an actual apology, not I'm sorry I did this, but I couldn't help myself apology.
Right.
And that's, I felt like, why Roy had to go, like, you know.
Totally.
F word right away, because there was nothing he could say to that. When somebody makes a true apology, there's no, you know, but he's still mad. Yeah. He's furious, but he's.
I think the reasons they were doing it also, and they kind of paired it with Nate, is to show how Jamie has improved from a bad place.
Yes.
And how Nate has gone in the opposite direction. And
yeah,
I think that is why they did it like that. But yeah,
it's a good scene. Don't get me wrong. And it serves lots of character purposes. What bugs me about it is that I feel like the show maybe is not is not questioning the idea that one man has to apologize for another to another man for what he said to the man, one man's girlfriend. Like that, I think that's a fault of the show, not a fault of this of Jamie or this scene, because I think it's very effective in what it's trying to do.
No, I agree. I agree with you. It hadn't really occurred to me because I was so blown away by the completeness of the apology that
it's a real apology. Real, sincere apology from Jamie Turk. Yeah, that's what an apology looks like, everybody.
Right? I also like the sight gag with Will Kitman kind of in the back of the scene, having seen the whole thing.
Deer in the headlights. Like, I just froze. I just thought I would stand here.
The noise he made, too. The Like, I can't even replicate it, but it was just so real.
Keely gets a call from Piers Morgan. It's just really an opportunity for a Piers Morgan joke. That was great. He's like, why don't you come on TV and I'll get a TV psychiatrist with Ted and we'll talk about it. And she's like, well, yeah, I appreciate the offer. Stupid Piers Morgan. If you don't know who Piers Morgan is, you're lucky. So in the coaching office, or no, out on the pitch. This is out on the pitch. And Ted's talking to the team. There's a line, we make a lot of choices in our lives, which starts on Ted, and then there's the Iraq focus to Nate. Dun, 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 choices, Nate. And then this is the scene that I think maybe the most puts the point on what they're trying to do in this whole episode. Ted quotes John Wooden, or as he calls him, John Obi-Wan Gandalf. You know, that's how coaches feel about John Wooden, is that he is multiple wizards put together, the great UCLA basketball coach and the author of The Pyramid of Success, the book that is being read by Beard, and that there's the pyramid is on the wall in the office. And this title of this episode is Inverting the Pyramid of Success, because things are out of whack and things are in the wrong orientation, things are in the wrong place. And this is the quote, which is, it is our choices, gentlemen, that show what we truly are far more than our abilities. Is that what this is about? Yeah, pretty much.
The quote, of course, not actually being from him, but is a quote from Dumbledore in Chamber of Secrets.
It's John Obi-Wan Gandalf.
Yeah.
They didn't mention Dumbledore.
all the wizards are the same.
It's the wizard. Yeah. Well, for those who don't know, John Wooden was the Wizard of Westwoods. That was what he was called. So it's like the levels of reference are amazing, is what I'm saying.
This is not three separate wizards.
No. You're getting it yet.
There's one bit of the scene that just to me is the pure Ted Lasso delight. Moments is when he says, like, well, you probably didn't read this in the paper, you read it on your phones, and like, I still get the paper, you can't cut out a cartoon. And I think it's Zorro says, like, oh, you can screenshot it and text it. And Isaac says,
my refrigerator has a TV on it. Yay!
I was like, that's copyright infringement, bro.
Oh, yeah.
That was so funny. I laughed so hard.
It was very random, team discussion. And before laying something heavy on them, I thought that was hysterical.
Suffice it to say, you saw it, but. I really did like that moment where Ted says, so as you all saw in the newspapers this morning, or really, quite honestly, nobody is reading newspapers anymore, so you probably saw it on your phone. It's like, I thought that was really good. It's like you're talking to a bunch of 20-something soccer players. They didn't read it in a newspaper.
Yeah.
Somebody texted the link to them, and then they read about it. But this is the, you know, Twitter. We got you, coach. He says, you know, I should have shared it with you. And they're very supportive of him, which is really great. And then they say, we'll find who did this and we'll get him. And he's like, no. You know, it's fine. I'm going to nip that in the butt. Horticulture baby. There it is. It's nip it in the bud like the flowers. But the moment that made me laugh on a second viewing is when they're saying, we're going to find who did this. One of the players shouts, follow the money.
Money.
Yes.
Same. I didn't catch that the first time either. And I did the second time.
Oh, that's so good. It's like, that's all the president's men. We're going to follow the money. So good. So good. Anyway, so that's all very supportive of Ted, which is, it's a nice scene. And yes, he quotes Dumbledore while referring to the Wizard of Westwood as two other wizards.
Yeah.
What is this show? What is it doing?
Amazing.
But John Wooden and the Pyramid of Success, I mean, this is a sainted idea of for coaches. And so to have in that later scene, Nate is looking at the pyramid of success before he has it out with Ted. And it is the title of this episode, too, that this is all like, you know, are these this is not how it's supposed to go, basically.
And it was even a signed copy that was up on the wall.
Yeah.
So let's see. Next scene is Mascot Idol, where Higgins is brought in Barkingham Palace with two potential greyhound puppies to be the new greyhound mascot. It's either Macy Greyhound or Tina Feyhound. I believe Macy so Greyhound wins.
I had missed the fact that Earl is called Earl because Earl Greyhound.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, James, for pulling my... I pointed that out reference. To you. Thank you very much. But yes, sure. I loved that.
I don't know how they thought Tina Feyhound was going to win.
Clearly, Macy Greyhound was the winner.
We get a brief odd scene with dog breeder Susie Campbell, who is super hot for Keely and keeps shaking her hand and is really, really, really into her. And Keely's like, well, this is an unexpected amount of how much you're into me. But then she needs to talk to Higgins about the fact that the money people that back Banter want to finance Keely going out on her own and starting a PR firm. And I just want to throw out there, between the guy who owns the oil company, the billionaire who is going to be angry at Sam in a little bit, Rupert, and then we've also got these mysterious money people who funded Banter and are now funding Keely's PR firm. There are a lot of shadowy rich people in the background, and I'm worried they're all out to get our friends. That's what I'm worried about.
Ugh, it feels... I'm so worried. I'm so worried, and yet very excited to see what they pull
from it. And I don't know if the people who the money people that back Banter and want to finance her firm, like, there's two ways to read that. One way is, look, they just want this stuff to happen, and so there are magic money people who give money, and they got a sponsor, and Banter is a hit, and great. It's not unreasonable to think that if she was one of the very first people on Banter as a promoter of Banter, and it has had a spectacular successful run, so they're rolling in dough, that they would not want to be in business with Keely for more stuff. It's not unreasonable. So that's all fine, and you can just sort of hand wave it. The other way to read it is, is there a reason we don't know who the money people are? Are they bad people?
I mean, I started to like conspiracy theory it down to the point of like, is Banter end-to-end encrypted? Do they have like the logs of everything? Did they put Rebecca and Sam together?
Nerd.
I don't know.
It's like multiple levels of distrust where you just think of them like Facebook and then immediately you can project all sorts of terribleness.
Or is one of the bad billionaires going to buy them out and ruin everything? I don't know. I don't know. I think that that's not a place that they've really gone deeply in Ted Lasso, but I think the idea that Rebecca has basically got this Premier League football club in her divorce, and Premier League football club is worth a lot of money, and it's sort of becoming the province of billionaires. And I feel like maybe they don't want to address it, but it is there in the background as part of the premise that what is the future of AFC Richmond? And I mean, she had one offer that she couldn't refuse, which was just to buy Sam out. But with all of these billionaires and other various rich people going around in the background, is that a story that's going to come back in season three? That they are little fish in a big pond, I guess. I don't know.
Mm. Well, I think it's certain that, you know, the Rupert buying a team, Rebecca's and her team ownership are going to be under threat in more ways than one. And that's, you know, I'm only looking forward to it because it's going to turn out well for us, heroes. But I don't want to go through the forest. I know that we have to go through the forest in the middle here and not, but the forest is not at the end of this fairy tale.
I'm assuming that the finale of next season is going to be it's West Ham United versus Richmond.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's got to be that. And it's
for the FA Cup.
For the FA Cup, yeah. And then they will they'll probably win. If it's a three-season show, they win. If they're going to do more seasons, they lose.
Yeah. That's so true. I just want to go back to Higgins for a moment in the... Mascot Idol scene. is one of my favorite, like, Higgins back and forths with Keeley, where he's like, she wants to talk to him. He's like, oh, I'm glad you came to me, you know, instead of Ted or Roy. Oh, well, they're in practice. Or Rebecca, well, she's the one I don't want to talk to right away. He's like, I'm happy to be on the list. But he's still like, as she says something, he says, oh, yes, and that will be really horrible, like, you know, Greek mythology proportions. And she's like, no, you know, like, he misunderstands her all the way through.
Well, except he's trying to be like, oh, yes, it's like this. He's trying to anticipate what it is. And then when he hears what it is, so it's a very silly misanticipating of it. And then when he hears what it is, he immediately dispenses good advice.
Right.
Yes. So
it's very Higgins. The
little arc of Higgins, kind of a little bit ridiculous, first off with puppies, but cute puppies, but still. And then coming around to a good mentor hopes you will move on.
Yes.
I did wonder how many times they had to film that scene, like, to have those puppies just sit there in his hands and not jumping around.
They're adorable. Adorable puppies. Okay, next scene is Sam on the phone to his dad. Not sure what decision he's going to make. He's thinking about it. His dad says, maybe you should just be aware and let the universe decide. Sometimes it's the right decision is made clear to you. Sam says, isn't this too important for the universe? And then what Sam sees is a bunch of kids playing soccer in the park, and a couple of them are wearing Sam Obasanya jerseys. And that, not only that, they are the Dubai Air jerseys with the tape over the sponsor logo. So they are completely inspired by Sam. And that's the moment that Sam has here, that the universe talks to Sam.
I was actually a little surprised by this. Like, as a consumer of the show, it was fine. You know, I enjoyed it. It was obvious what they were doing here. But the fact that Ted Lasso did something obvious was a little surprising to me, because so often, you know, they go right when you expect left and left when you expect right. And in this case, they walked exactly the way a sitcom or something would walk.
Well,
you know, and
not
it
a sitcom,
was surprising.
Not a sitcom, Casey. And this is why I agree with you that Ted Lasso is great, because it's oblique a lot of the time. But it's not a sitcom. It's a sports movie. And this is, and there are moments where I'm like, all right, like at the end of this episode where they very suddenly score two goals to get the draw that gets them advanced. And I have those moments where I'm like, right, it's a sports movie, right? Because that's their genre, that is their favorite. Is this is kind of a cheesy sports movie where moments like this happen. And that's why I was I not only willing to forgive it, but I enjoyed that moment, because it's that kind of feel to me. Is it's that inspirational moment that happens. But yeah, I mean, I get it. It is kind of obvious, but also, you know, that's the moment, which is maybe things will reveal themselves to you. I would argue that the biggest reveal of why Sam should say no to Okufu is Okufu's reaction to him saying no. But, you know, that happens.
Yeah.
That happens later.
Yep.
Roy and Keeley. This is the scene where he says that Jamie apologized and he didn't beat him up because he's grown as a person. And she says that she's got her big deal. He says, look at you, the boss. And she says, shut your pretty mouth. And they open champagne, which he says in a great reference, we didn't open it for England getting 0 points in Eurovision. Oh, such a timely reference. Or when the neighbors ran over their snake. Amazing. And then she gets the Vanity Fair layout, and all the pictures are of her and not the picture that she took with him. And this is, okay, let's talk about Roy and Keeley's relationship, because on one level, I feel really uncomfortable that the show is trying to create some drama about their relationship that is unnecessary, because everything we've seen is that their relationship is solid, and that I've been trained by too many sitcoms, Casey, talking about sitcoms, that like that have this belief that stable relationships can't exist on shows because they're boring, which I don't think is true. So there's that part of this that bothers me. Thematically, the part that I appreciate about this is about Roy, because this is about Roy feeling kind of unsure and untethered, because everything is happening for Keeley, and it's not happening for him. It's happening for his partner. He's kind of doing his thing, but remember, he is just retired, and although he's coaching, like, he's sort of like in this afterlife, and this is her moment, and she is exploding. And he recognizes, as he says later in the Diamond Dogs meeting that he crashes, that it's like they shouldn't put his picture in Vanity Fair. It mm-hmm. is all about her. But at the same time, it's troubling for, and then she does, can't, she won't travel to Spain with him because
for 6 weeks.
For 6 weeks, because she's got to do work, which is like, Roy, it's sweet that you thought that your girlfriend with a startup, the brand new startup, would have 6 weeks before her next job. That's not going to happen. But like, this is all of a piece, so we might as well talk about it now, which is, I don't love the, are you breaking up with me? No, that's silly. I hope that that was like the show talking to itself and saying that that was stupid, because this is not about that, but it is about sort of this, it's not even power dynamic. It's like everything's going on for her, and now, and he's happy for her, but also he feels like left behind a little bit. And I understand that feeling. I'm not necessarily saying that it's the right feeling for him to have, but I understand why it would be a human reaction to be proud of her, but also feel like, you know, he was the star, right? Literally, he was the star of soccer. And now she's the boss, and it's different. And I like that aspect of this, while disliking the kind of playing that the show seems to be doing with their relationship, as if there's relationship drama here. What do y'all think?
I mean, he says in that first scene where she tells him about the PR offer and he picks her up like a toy, he says some throwaway line about she's not going to have any time for
James!
Anymore.
Oh, I was going to say this. You took yes. it from me because I felt so smart. This was my moment where I feel smart.
Casey, we can edit this out of the podcast. Nope. It's go for it.
No, it's so true. And now I'm totally derailing your thunder.
I choose to view time from a non-linear perspective.
Well done. Well done.
Nice.
No, James, you're so right, though, because I didn't think anything of it at first. I thought he was just being silly, and it was only upon rewatching that I called that out in my notes, that, oh, is this setting up for his, and like you said, Jason, like, I don't know if it's a power play or what, but his, like, oh, let's bugger off to wherever it was for 6 weeks. Is he just trying to cling and not let go of her? Almost like a possession, but that's not necessarily what it is. It's just that he doesn't want to lose her focus on him.
He doesn't want to share her, which I get.
Exactly.
Well, and two, don't forget, this is pretty much his first real relationship. All of his
adult relationship.
Yeah. They've all been, you know, one-offs because he's a football star and like that sort of thing. And the whole relationship started out with him, you know, wanting to be very reserved to protect himself and protect the relationship that he had mm-hmm. with Keely. And then all of these things coming into place, and he's feeling almost as if she doesn't need him.
Yes.
And that's never been something that he's experienced before. And he obviously really loves and cares for her in a way that is so vital to who he is as a person, that he's trying to figure out how he can be supportive while still, you know, doing things that he wants. And here his great idea of, oh my gosh, this is the first vacation I've had since I was 12. Let's go. And you don't start your job yet, so let's just run away. And I cared enough about you because I know you're still like really starting, like you're starting to do the work for the job. So I've made sure that it has Wi-Fi, and let's just come and like have this moment of time together and like have a break and a breather in the midst of all of this everything. And she just can't, which makes sense. And but in Turnabout, she wants him to get this vacation that he hasn't had since he was 12, and she's going to be boring, locked in a room, working all day. And so this miscommunication was done well in a way that most, you know, relationship romance tropes doesn't work. And I can't wait to see what they do with it.
I did think, though, you know, buying somebody a surprise 6 week vacation is just so not respecting their time yep. and their importance. Yes.
I'm willing to accept, like, I can headcanon it a little bit and say perhaps there was a 6 week term mentioned that the move into the new office is in 6 weeks or like something. And so he read that as a let's run away for those 6 weeks, that term was out there. But as she says, I already started working on this a week ago while I was still here. I'm not gonna run away. But also it's a sitcom, and yeah, okay. But I can kind of headcanon it a little bit, because it is a little bit of a leap. Also, I will say this is an inversion of traditional gender roles in relationships, mm-hmm. and the show knows it. I've seen this scene a lot of times. It's just never the gruff soccer player who's the one buying the tickets and saying run away. Mm-hmm. It's also not the gruff soccer player who's told shut your pretty mouth. That's an intentional piece of dialogue that this show is trying to say, sort of like who's the one who's like, again, who's the one who's got all the juice and the power? And in traditional kind of storytelling, it's the man, and then there's the supportive wife. And here's big Roy Kent, and he needs to be the supportive wife right now, right? In the terms of historic traditional gender roles, just sort of saying that we're playing with the tropes here. So it's I get it. Also, Roy just retired, right? Like I feel like one of the fascinating things that has not been dealt with quite as much as it could be, that's very rich for exploration, is the fact that he literally is at sea. Like his whole life, when he says, I haven't taken a vacation since I was 12, where I wasn't, you know, prepping for the season or rehabbing my knee, is you know, the most midlife of midlife crises, which is he's been playing a kid's sport his entire life, and it's over now. And who is he? I mean, he did the pundit thing, he's done the coaching thing, and that's maybe his direction. But like, has Roy Kent thought about what his role is that he wants to inhabit? And when he sees Keeley doing this, it's not just about being the supportive boyfriend. It's also sort of like, well, what am I doing? And I think that's going on here. I wish that there were not like, are we breaking up and things like that? Because like, no, you dummy. Of course we're not. Like, no, that's not what this is about. This is about something different.
Did anyone else think he was going to propose at that point? Because I certainly did.
I did.
Been hovering out there.
Yeah, it makes sense. I don't know. This just that whole like not post-credit scene, but that flash forward. I didn't particularly care for Roy and Keeley's, because it seemed out of character for their relationship as it's been this season. You know, Roy has been exceptionally considerate and giving. And yes, I guess you could say this is giving and considerate. But like you guys had said just a minute ago, who books a 6 week vacation just as a surprise? Like that's very out of character for this new revised Roy Kent, for Roy Kent 2.0. And it was hard for me to buy that, and it's still hard for me to buy it. Maybe we'll dig into this more next season, but that was one of the things that left a really kind of gross taste in my mouth.
For the record, anyone is feel free to purchase a 6 week vacation by the beach for me. I'm just throwing that out there.
I just wondered, so is he going to bring Phoebe now? Because that would be the best vacation ever.
Oh, my gosh.
That was what I was thinking is Keeley needs to come over for a couple of weekends.
Yep.
Phoebe mm-hmm. can come and they will do some you know, beach stuff by the seaside. And you know, boys week with the Diamond Dogs.
Take
your time and be.
I
at
love
the
that. I'm here for
make
that.
Make the best of it. And Keeley can pop over for a couple of weekends, and it'll be okay.
He did seem to leave the tickets on the desk, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. But they had to come back for the Mirabelle anyways. So.
And even though their tickets are made of paper, they can still be rebooked by a computer.
Yeah.
Thanks, Kathy.
And that is also, I mean, the paper tickets, and they make a joke of it, but also that's them saying this is a scene you've seen before. You have literally seen, it may be, somebody could let us know, it may literally be a scene from a movie where somebody brings the paper tickets and says, let's go on an adventure. And the other partner is like, I can't go. Like, it feels very much like a classic moment right down to the paper tickets.
I think I've seen
seen that before, too.
Yeah, it's got to be. If it's not a reference to a movie, it's a reference to literally every movie and TV show. It's one of those. Ted and Beard get their conversation. You going to say anything to Nate? He says, you know, apologies are like cat's babies. Or it's like cat's babies and apologies. You've got to let all of them come to you. It's cat's babies and apologies. And he's like, Nate will be fine. And Beard's point is, it will help you to talk to Nate. Yeah. You need to not bottle this up. You need to address this with Nate. which he does, right? He does in the end follow Beard's advice and go talk to Nate. It goes great, by the way. So we'll get to that soon. in a little bit.
Another thing that struck me about this episode, and this isn't new news, but I felt like it was the point was hammered home more this episode than any of the others, is that Beard is almost like the puppet master to Ted, in that, you know, Ted is often, if not always, looking to Beard for confirmation of, mm-hmm. you know, things he should or should not do and whatnot. And he listens to Beard. Again, this is not new news, but it was striking to me. I forget, maybe it was when they were talking about asking the team whether or not to continue with the fake nine or false nine, whatever it's called. And Ted doesn't move a muscle until he looks over at Beard and gets approval. And even though Ted is ostensibly the head coach, it feels or felt to me more in this episode than any other that Beard is almost kind of calling the shots in a lot of Ted's life in a lot of ways, despite Beard's life, as we found out, being in a bit of a shambles in and of itself. But he seems to be a very good steward for Ted in a even more so than I thought previously.
Yeah, I don't know about calling the shots. I would say he is also an Obi-Wan Gandalf type person, right?
Yeah.
Where he's sort of like got some wisdom and he's like confirmation for Ted, pushes back when he needs to. He's a trusted person that, you know, Beard is not necessarily going to be the head coach, but Beard has the wisdom to help reassure Ted about what he should do.
And the knowledge for the game.
And more of the knowledge of the game. It's
also
true.
I would say it's a lot easier to help other people's lives than try and fix your own.
100%.
That's definitely true. She and Jane break up and get back together during a conversation that they have here. So that's the Beard Show. Different show. You know, the only one episode that we got to see of it.
Yep. I also loved, before we move on, the line about, you know, if your mustache flew off and Ted says, I'd look like the guy from The Hangover, which I'm assuming he means Ed Helms.
I think it's Ed Helms.
Yeah.
But Beard says
Bradley Cooper.
And
you're
Ted,
too good to me.
It's so good. Oh, I love that exchange so much.
It's good. Really good. Keely breaks the news to Rebecca. Basically, she walks in and says, can we talk? And then cut to, they're both crying, sitting on the couch. She says, you helped this panda become a lion. That was one of the lines that I wrote down. And Rupert, we have the news here that Rupert has bought out West Ham because, you know, we are never going to be rid of Rupert. And that sets up stuff that happens later. So this is Keely finally breaking the news. And it's nice. It's very much like, I'm happy for you and you're doing a great job and you should hire your best friend to work with you and all of that. It's very sweet.
So sweet.
Which brings us to game day. We get Don't Bring Me Down, and there's a montage, and they filter into the pub really fast, and Nate is staring at the John Wooden pyramid on the wall, and are we going to use the false nine? You'd be fools not to, says Nate.
Yeah.
What is wrong with that guy? Well, there's a lot. Roy would like to have a conversation. I could use some advice. He summons the diamond dogs to explain that they didn't use a picture.
Whoop.
And it hurt my feeling. It hurt my feeling. She looks so great, so natural, it would have been weird for me to be in it. And then Nate says he wants to confess something and everybody's ready for the big confession, but instead it's just that he's kissing Keely. And Roy, as we've discussed earlier, says, it's okay, we're good, don't worry about it. And he's like, no, I deserve to be headbutted. Anyway, the Diamond Dogs is concluded, at which point Roy says, wait a second, you mean the Diamond Dogs just talk about things and then there's not necessarily any resolution at all? And they're like, yeah, he goes, that's cool, and he walks out. And then my single favorite moment is that that's cool and walks out, and it is the validation of the gruff person who doesn't ever give you validation. And when he does it begrudgingly, it's the greatest thing in the world. Ted does the fist pump. And Beard just says silently, mouths the words, oh my God.
It's so good. It's such a great moment.
I once had for a summer internship, I once had a boss who was like this, who was the super gruff, grumpy. And I learned that this is a management strategy, is if you're the super gruff, grumpy, I mean, we talk about various daddy issues in this show, including Nate's. Roy Kent, as a future manager of people and current assistant coach, like, this is one technique, which is if you are a withholding person and then you let a little glimmer of something out, everybody goes, oh my God, he didn't yell at me or whatever. And that's what's going on here. It's sweet, but it's also kind of funny because that, like, one time as a TV intern, when I had this gruff producer as my boss, I wrote a thing for the anchors to say, and he came up to me and said, that's good copy, and walked away. And like, well, that was 30 years ago and I still remember it, so you tell me. It was like Roy Kent saying, that's cool. Oh my God.
It was such a perfect moment.
It's so good. So yeah, Roy is going to be in the Diamond Dogs, the junkyard dog. He's the junkyard dog.
One day pass.
Straight in to the Diamond Dogs. They need a slot because Nate's not going to be there anymore. So, halftime, they're down 2-0. Nate is angry at the players for not doing his brilliant scheme right. A spiral is happening here. Leads to the best visual joke in the history of Ted Lasso, which is, look at those guys out there. They look like a Renaissance painting portraying masculine melancholy.
Oh, it was beautiful.
Cut to.
Perfect.
And there. the Will dropping the water bottle.
So like, they couldn't hold it. They couldn't
so
stick.
So good. And Isaac's in the middle, and he's got his fist on his chin. And God, it's so good. Nate says we should abandon the false nine strategy because the players are failures. Roy says ask the players if they want to keep playing it. Beard gives that nod, little nod from Beard. And so they go out, and Ted says, well, what do you think? And it's Jan Moss, the guy who can never do anything but say the truth, even if it's unpleasant, says the tactic is sound. And so, also, Zorro, you totally blew that first goal. And so they huddle up, but instead of doing Richmond on three, Isaac walks over to the Believe poster and puts his hand on it, and everybody goes around it, and the music swells, and in the most Friday Night Lights, it's a sports movie, people, thing that you possibly could imagine, they all touch the Believe sign, and then they go out there. So you know what's going to happen next. But first, Ted and Nate.
Yep. But and I before we leave the Believe sign, yes. I just got to say, like, this is straight cheese. It is straight.
It is
like cheese whiz.
It's sports,
cheese.
I loved it.
I loved it. It was such a great moment, and I don't care how cheesy and predictable it was. I am so here for it. I absolutely.
Kathy,
loved it.
Did you say it was Velveeta?
I did.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't even hear you.
Which isn't cheese, so I'm not sure.
Boo.
Well, it's an artificially produced cheese, just like this is an artificially produced. No, this is what I say. Like, you gotta. Like, I don't know. I mean, you can not like this, I guess, if you want, but like, it's a sports movie cliche. That's what it is. It's meant to be that. And it's meant to be the tug at your heartstrings moment where the team turns it around in the locker room. I mean, like, that's literally what it is, right?
And it's so much more poignant because Ted Lasso doesn't normally do those tropes. And so when they do choose to do the things that are hit you in the feels, it hits you in the feel.
And the point is that this is counterpoint to what's going to come, right? Like, this is the rousing sports movie thing happening while the emotional consequences are hitting, which is exactly how this season was always going to end and should have always ended, which is it ends in triumph, rousing sports movie triumph. Because the first season ended in surprising failure. Second season ends in triumph, but the emotional consequences are devastating. And so we get this high, and there's going to be a high in a little bit. And in between, we get the scene with Ted and Nate where it all falls apart.
And I think that they had to reference the sign to sort of build up its prominence so that when the sign is murdered later on.
Oh, the sign's still there. Remember that good old sign? I'm glad that sign's still there. Oh, no.
No.
No. What have you done? So, Ted does what Beard suggested, which is you got to talk to him. And he says, everything okay? He's trying to be bright and cheery, Ted. And Nate's like, yeah, sure, Ted. Everything's okay. And it's that moment where, like, if you're a conflict avoider, that's all you need. You can be out of there. Oh, good. I don't need to have this out. And Ted's like, no, you're obviously pissed off at me. What do I have to learn here? And that's how he phrases it, which I think is interesting. Like, it is kind of, what did I do wrong? But it's making it all about him and not about Nate. Which is, you could argue, is sort of egocentric. You could also argue that he's trying to defuse it a little bit and give Nate the ability to be honest about what Ted did wrong that's made him angry. But it doesn't really matter because Nate's got his speech, which is spectacularly narcissistic. about you made me feel like I was the most important thing in the world, and then you abandoned me and I tried to get your attention. You don't have the photo I gave you in my office, which on one level is ridiculous. It's like, how dare you not display things I give you? And on another level is tragic because Ted actually put it next to a picture of his son at his house, and that is tragic, tragic misunderstanding. He's like, you'll blame the false nine on me when it fails, it succeeds. And you should have, if I hadn't helped you, they would have shipped you back to Kansas. And then he says, with your son, which is the, I did it all because of you, Dad, moment of this speech. I belong here. I earned this. But like leaving out the fact that Ted is the one who gave him his chance. And it all comes out. So yeah, this is the big moment. How's everybody doing? How's everybody feeling about this?
Woof. I mean, just golly. I such visceral hatred for Nate. Like, oh, I dislike the character so much. And again, as it sat with me and as we've talked even more so, like I appreciate more and more. Well, appreciate might be too generous, but I understand more and more, like you were saying, Jason, like how did you end up here? And yes, it takes a very broken man to end here. But I do sort of conceive how it can be. Again, I think Nick Mohammed's performance was excellent. Like the crying was the right amount of crying for it to be believable. Mm-hmm. Like everything about the scene, while I hated it, it was so well done. But golly, and he's wearing all black. Nate is wearing all black, which I'm sure is not an accident. He's looking gray as hell. Like every part of this was so well executed. That's very true. I didn't think of it that way. But yeah, very Vader energy here. It's so well executed, even though I hate it so much.
Yeah, that's the hardest part.
I've definitely heard comparisons to Vader and his fall, but I think he's more of a Kylo Ren. He's just a whiny baby.
That's a good point.
No, I mentioned it's super narcissistic speech. There was a moment in the middle of it where watching it a second time, I was like, oh my God, it is all about him. It's all about Nate's worldview of himself. And it's, I think this is really realistic because first off, people who do bad stuff don't think they're the villain. They think they're the hero. And this is a great case where you've got things that are positive input that he reads as negative, negative input, which he reads as positive. He is simultaneously incredibly self-aggrandizing and incredibly self-loathing. It is all inconsistent because that's why it felt real to me, is that he's messed up and he's going to make himself the hero and he's going to make himself the victim. And not all of the points that he's making are untrue, but they are often twisted in the most bizarre ways. And also, I would argue he never said anything. But if he did, we could also argue he was let down by the fact that this has been going on all season and nobody has called him out for any of it along the way. So that is a, I think it's a what went wrong kind of thing, which is like not, I'm sorry, Nate, how can we repair this, as much as it is, for him to get to this point, everybody bears a little bit of responsibility too, because could we have stopped him and helped him before this?
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that this is the first scene they've had alone together since like 3/4 of the way through season one. They didn't have a single scene alone together in this season. So it's kind of like he does have a point in some ways that, Ted has not given him that one-on-one attention that he craves. But yeah, it was that, as you say, the whole just speech just annoyed me.
I think that the thing that Ted is missing, and they're all missing about Nate, is that they they made him an assistant coach, but they didn't really mentor him in how to work with the team. And so by the point that they're at now, Nate is saying like, oh, they suck. If they didn't suck, this strategy would work. He's amazed that they're going to ask the team what to do, when it's his, he's got his brilliant tactic, but nobody has helped him with that. And I'll go back to that, Isaac situation. I think it was episode 5 where they need somebody to talk to Isaac. Okay, maybe it is not Nate, but they haven't helped Nate to become somebody good at talking and inspiring the team at all. And so he doesn't know what he only has one role model for how to talk to, you know, people you're supposed to mentor. And that is like his father. And you talk down to them and you belittle them and you'd completely make, you know, minimize their skills and abilities. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I'm not trying to be a Nate apologist, but I think that's why it all comes together in this one game, especially, is that, you know, it's Nate's false nine and it requires the team to play, to execute it. And they can. And obviously we find out that they do. And so, I mean, I don't want to jump ahead to the end of the, you know, the post halftime situation, but I think you see it, that's what really causes Nate to be completely disgusted by the end, is that it's the players, not Nate, who make the game, who get credit for winning the game as they should.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, this show omits a lot, so I would say I don't know if I entirely believe that Nate hasn't been given more guidance about how to deal with things, because I think some of that stuff probably has happened off camera. He is running practices and things like that. But yeah, I think it's definitely arguable that Nate got not too much too soon, but too much responsibility without more guidance too soon. Ted has confidence in Nate, but he gives him all this power, and then it's like Nate was the kit man, right? Like, I think there's definitely an argument to be made that Nate's competence was recognized, but there was, you know, like, there's that like drop off of like, oh great, you're great at your job, now do it, without mm-hmm. maybe more attention that caused this to happen. I think that's a fair mm-hmm. argument.
Yeah, I mean, there is the one bit with Beard telling him, you know, that was no good what you did with Colin, and you need to make that right, and he did. Like, but there were many other times, including when he's, you know, complaining about the players, where nobody says like, that's just the wrong attitude to have if you want to be a coach.
Yeah.
Chris, is time running out on Richmond's chance to advance? Only if you think of time as linear, Arlo. Well, and I do. Just funny, nonsensical commentary from the box. By the way, we'll just mention that there are playoffs. So presumably if they didn't just advance, they would be in the playoffs to advance, because they take the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth teams and mm-hmm. play them off against each other for the third relegation. It's third promotion spot. It's fine. It doesn't matter. The show is basically saying, we're not going to do that. So why even mention it? Because there's not a surprise episode where they're in the playoffs later. So they're one goal to promotion, because all the other things have finished, because Sam has scored. So everything is there. I want to point out, by the way, that this season began, there's so many parallels to the beginning of the season. One of them is that the season began with Richmond in a funk because all they do is tie. Well, guess what? All they have to do here is tie. They tie to win.
Yeah.
All they have to do is just a tie. We celebrate a tie here. This is not a win. It's a tie, but it does the job. Mm-hmm. Long ball to Jamie. He looks super offside, perhaps out of frame. There's somebody else who's ahead. Perhaps he started his run while he was onside. I'm just saying, I'm surprised they didn't call this back, because I watch soccer and it's always called back. He's fouled in the box. He gives the kick to Danny. Look at Jamie's growth as a person, that he's not only making the extra pass, but he knows he's going to give this to Danny, who hasn't made a kick since episode one when he killed the dog.
R.I.P. Earl.
R.I.P. Yes. Earl, written on his boot.
And the hat on Macy Greyhound was so cute.
Yep. And he looks at the puppy. He says, football is life. Kicks it to the exact same place as he did in episode one, all of the parallels with episode one of this season. And hooray, it's a tie, but they've tied to win. They're going to get promoted back to the Premier League. Although, as Arlo White, voice of NPC soccer, says, they remain a club without a major trophy.
Dun, dun, dun.
Interesting detail there, Arlo. I do believe time is linear, though. I'm with you there. Go back to the locker room. The believe sign has been torn and placed on Ted's desk. Yeah, that's gone well. Nate didn't celebrate with the team, by the way. He just stormed off and tore the belief sign and went away. Again, talking about Akufo's access to Richmond, he is in a side room and immediately during the celebration is led into the sign room to talk to Sam. One could argue that in the heat of the moment when you've just won promotion into the Premier League and played well and all of that, this is the last time, your worst time to get somebody to tell you whether they're going to leave or not. But anyway, he's going to tell Akufo that he's not going to come. He's going to stay at Richmond. And I saw a TV critic who pointed out that the actor who plays Akufo is a very, very funny comic actor, and they were confused about why he was playing this sort of a little bit kind of serious billionaire role. And this is where we get the answer.
Yeah. Which
is, he has a ridiculously hilarious tantrum. It's such a great moment where he's like, well, you know, I appreciate the opportunity. And he flies all the way off the handle to the point where he shouts a lot of things like, you'll never make the Nigerian team again, and I'll make your life hell, and it's you're ruined. And then he goes and he finds the dummy out in the hallway and he strangles it and puts it down and kicks it and pretends to poop on it. And then the handshake man does the fake out handshake. So I guess not working for that crazy person was probably the right thing to do. Sam?
And this is the one thing that I did not love about this episode, because it was funny sort of when it was happening, but then I thought, why? It undermines Sam's decision, because like we get to go like, phew, he made the right choice. I mean, a decision like that is never going to have normally such a clear, oh, wow, he really did the right thing. And then that I just think, like, why couldn't the guy just be like mad-ish, but be like a gentleman about it? Instead, like, you know, you have this one big black billionaire on the show, and he turns out to be a complete wingnut, and that bothered me. Once it was over, and because he was funny, like he obviously is really good at that kind of, and also all the Nigerian epithets were anti-Nigerian, you know. Yeah. I always wondering from Ghanaian, the beginning why he why he was going, you know, this, when they were going, they had one little comment about the jollof rice when they were in a restaurant together, and I thought, well, it goes deeper than just like the recipe for jollof rice. I would be interested to see like if some Ghanaian Nigerian antipathy doesn't come out at some point, but I didn't expect that. So,
and both the actors actually had some Ghanaian and Nigerian background too.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So, you know, it wasn't like, because I wondered why get in the American guy to play him, but you know, he had some connection.
And I love his acting in Veep. He plays one of my favorite characters in Veep. And seeing this more serious character, and then getting to kind of release the hounds to be his comedic self, just was so, I really enjoyed it on a visual entertainment level. I agree with you, Gene. I didn't love the, you know, the black billionaire gets the moment of losing his mind. So a little bit torn there, but man, it was funny.
And that character is portrayed pretty broadly throughout, right? With his handshake man and his and his helicopter and the actors in the restaurant and all of, and the actors
was that
at the museum.
To be real, like I wondered, like, was that supposed to be serious, or was that a joke in the show? Okay, I wondered.
No.
They were okay, like the museum too.
Yeah,
like all actors.
Yeah.
I think it was all, and that probably was Banksy, at least in universe Banksy, not real Banksy.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
In universe Banksy.
Okay.
Maybe it's real Banksy. We don't know.
I mean, I saw people saying that would be the perfect cover for Banksy to go on TV playing Banksy, but I don't think it is.
Probably not. So I love Sam's reaction to it, which he's like,
"Yeah,
okay."
It's why we love Sam.
It's good. Yeah. So Ted has a press conference. Trent Crim isn't there. And he opens by saying, I have struggled with anxiety, and I think this is an important conversation we need to have about mental health in athletics, which could not be more timely given the what's happened in the last 6 months in tennis and at the Olympics with really high-profile athletes talking about struggling with anxiety and other mental health issues. And Ted Lasso was ahead of the curve there. Good timing, Ted Lasso. But we cut away. But it's addressed in that moment in the press conference. What happened to Trent Crim? Oh no! I hope he's okay. Hope he didn't get in a bike accident. He has that vibe. Anyway, we get the replay of the scene from season one where it's go up to visit Rebecca. He doesn't want champagne, sparkling or still water. Right. Still there water. It remains there water.
There was a post-it note, like where the sign, the belief sign was ripped up, there was a post-it note on his phone, and I think it said, when does H2O become bubbles? Question mark. And that was like covering the dial pad of the phone, so this was clearly important to him.
Interesting. Her response to him talking about, I thought it was still water, or, you know, it rains being water. She was like, there's no greater education than travel, was her response.
I love that.
That was a laugh out loud line. So Sam comes in, super awkward. Ted tries to get out of there. No, you stay. And ultimately, Sam says to Ted what he intended to say to Rebecca, which is that, I wish I could say it was because of my feelings for you, Ted. Sure. But the truth is, I think I need to stop worrying about how others feel about me. I'm staying because it's what's best for me and my personal journey. And then he leaves. And in a moment where I know it's like it's hanging a lantern on the joke, but it made the joke that much better that he says, I think he really meant that was for you. And she's like, yeah, I know, Ted. It's because I love that. Rather than it being like all the audience being like, oh, he's saying it to Ted, but he really means that it's for her. And then Ted's like, yeah, you know, I noticed that too. Love it. It's great. And also I like that it's Sam saying, I didn't make this decision because of you or our relationship. Yeah. I made it for me. I this is about me. And I wanted to be clear about that. And I think that's good. Good for Sam.
Yes. Agreed.
That brings us to my favorite character on Ted Lasso, which is Trent Crim.
The independent.
He is waiting outside. Ted asks if he's been in a bicycle accident. He says, I don't know how to ride a bicycle. And he's like, well, what gave you that idea? Was it the hair and the whole vibe? He says, I'm no longer a reporter. I'm looking for something different. All those hot takes out there about how he was violating journalistic ethics by telling Ted in the last episode that his confidential source was Nate. He was, and he knew it. Because Trent Crim was tired of his job and wanted to get out of journalism. I'm not saying that I know people who are in the exact same position, but I know so many people who reached this point in journalism. It felt really familiar to me where they're like, I'm looking for something different. And now that means, as Ted points out, he's Trent Crim independent. The same joke that Trent's dad made. He sounds like a really fun guy.
this whole exchange left me wanting so much more, and that's a good thing. Like, I loved it so much, and I really hope we see more of Trent Crim independent. I also wanted to,
I love our chats was his last line. Yes. With Ted. Yeah. I love our chats.
I have to point out, as the, I think, appropriate representative for such things, the car casting for Trent Crim. I don't remember the exact model number, but it's an old Mercedes coupe from like the, I don't know, late 70s, early 80s, something like that. I think that it's a perfect car for Trent in much the same way that I think all of the car casting for basically everyone is so perfect. I just loved that was what they chose for him. And then I guess he locked his keys in the car because he is that kind of a guy.
I thought the locked keys was going to be a plot point because he has to come back and get the car at some point. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, he has to end up with Keeley's job because I think that is how he is going to be in the next season.
Maybe. He is coming back. We know that he is coming back. Doc Sharon.
Dr. Sharon will both be back in some form next season.
Yeah.
So I thought that because they don't usually do anything accidentally. So the locked keys just felt like, okay, where's the payoff?
Stay tuned for season three.
So- it was so long. Like that beat was so long. It was hilarious.
Like, remember this.
You know that, I don't know if you've seen it, but there, it goes around from time to time. Somebody tweets out that scene from that Columbo episode where he literally walks all the way across a whole factory floor and then gets to a rotary dial phone and picks it up and looks at a piece of paper that's got a phone number on it and then dials all 7 digits of the phone number and then waits and waits and waits and then somebody picks up and they're like, wow, in the 70s they had nothing but time. And the truth is that a lot of those Columbo episodes, they supersized them because they were written to be an hour long and then they got put in a movie slot, so they had to pad. But I was thinking about that scene, which if you haven't seen it, it's amazing. It's like, here's 30 seconds of filler in the scene where Trent is looking for his keys, and it has no resolution. He ends up sort of like looking in the, I think he's looking in the car to see that he's left the keys in the car, and then that's it. That's all we get. So there'll be a flashback to that.
To like pull out his phone or whatever. I love how young Trent looked. Like the weight of being the journalist has lifted off of him.
He got out of that racket.
As opposed to Nate, who looks so much older now. I thought that was really, really beautifully done.
Yep. Love Trent Crim. My Twitter account is just a Trent Crim fan account now. From now on. It's great. More Trent Crim, please. So now, should I play the music here as if it's over, and then we get the Lord of the Rings style. We get three other things that happen. 5 days later, we get the scene that we've already really discussed, which is Roy and Keeley, and Roy buying the plane tickets, and she's saying, "I gotta work." I don't know if there's more for us to say here. I feel like we covered this earlier, but if anybody has the,
I liked his growl at the end, just when he faced off with the cheetah.
Yeah, with the cheetah statue. 3 weeks later, Sam is buying a space where he's going to put a Nigerian restaurant inspired by Crazy Billionaire.
I think it's the same restaurant. It's the same building.
I was wondering that too.
I didn't go back and look and see if it's the same space.
It looks the same to
me.
Yeah, I think it was. So I think and that's good because it means it had a food license or something.
Yeah.
So it doesn't need to go through all that paperwork.
But this is Sam. Like, I really like this because not only is it Sam becoming more than just a soccer player, it's also him bringing part of his home to London, but also putting down roots in London, essentially, at the same time. That I think it's a sweet little moment for that character that he wants to bring home to him, but it's also him kind of committing to where he lives now as his home. It's both of those things. I think it's really sweet.
And it's nice that he's sharing where he came from, you know, in season one, where he got the birthday gift full of treats from home. And I have a feeling that he's had a very similar life as Roy, where he's kind of been moving around and traveling and been away from home for so long and has such a good relationship with his family that, okay, yes, he's made the decision to stay in London, but also he's making the decision to be proud of his heritage in a way that's not just becoming English, which I think is really powerful.
2 months later, we are at West Ham, which friend of the show Philip Michaels, who is a big soccer fan, points out the hilarity of making West Ham the villains of anything. dun, 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 dun. It's West Ham United. Oh no, they're terrible. Rupert is there. The lined up like stormtroopers. West Ham players are out there doing their drills. Rupert is there whispering at the coach, who we all know is going to be the Wonder Kid himself. And yes, there it is. We are left with Nate. He turns to the camera. His hair is gray. We move in and he walks toward the camera. And the last shot of this season is the eyes of Nate, just as the first shot of this season was the eyes of Nate. And that's the end of season two of Ted Lasso.
And Nate is in shadow as well at the end of this. You know, just to rub in the fact that
I did not catch that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. You know, I didn't think of this until just now, but I feel like there's very big Karate Kid vibes to this when they go to like the Cobra Kai dojo and it's all, you know, yes, sensei. And here it's coach, sir, you know, yes. And it's a very, yeah. very similar like dichotomy or difference from the way it works at Richmond.
Right.
And it makes sense. And obviously we knew the second we saw this person with their back turned to us, who it was going to be. But yet, even still, even knowing who was about to turn around, God, I hate that character so much.
Yep.
It's brutal.
One thing I thought is that Nate basically has all of Richmond's strategies. So it's even worse that they've lost him because they're going to have to come up with a whole new playbook or whatever it is.
Well, especially because you know Nate will use whatever he can.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, it gives you a lot of drama for next season because as they point out, I mean, Ted points out it's good because we won't have to see Rupert coming because we'll be on his schedule, right? That's yes. home and home in everybody in the Premier League. That also means structurally for season three, it allows them to structure their storyline around those two meetings with and maybe more if there's a final in the FA Cup. There would be a third meeting between West Ham and Richmond, and that's interesting. Again, very amusing that West Ham is the big baddie, but mm-hmm. fair enough. Like, I guess, you know, Chelsea didn't want to do it. I don't know. it's fine. It's West Ham. So yeah, that's it. So this is the fall of Nate is complete, and Rupert is the devil on his shoulder, right? He's whispering. Yeah. The only time we ever see Rupert with Nate, he's whispered something in his ear.
Sweet nothings.
That's right. Yeah, don't you think he looks tired? Something like that. That's a reference.
Referencing.
Okay, so that's it. We reached the end now. Of the end of the season of Ted Lasso, but not of the season of Football is Life, because there is going to be a special season wrap-up episode of Football is Life that is coming in the near future. So we'll save our overall impressions for that. But if anybody has any final thoughts about episode 12, a little bit more kind of like focusing on episode 12, now is your chance. Anybody?
I feel like, and I think I made this point earlier, I feel very much like this episode really turned my opinion of season two around. And I felt like every episode of season two, for the most part, was a little bit better than the last. And it climbed and climbed in terms of how much I enjoyed them. But this one really brought a lot together, more than I expected it, but more than I thought they would be able to accomplish. And even though in some ways I'm really disappointed by where it's ended, Nate, I still think that it was an incredibly great ending of the season. And I know I've said this a couple times already, but I'm really looking forward to going back and Zapruder-ing, particularly season two, and seeing all the things that I just didn't pick up on because I didn't know where we were headed. And now I'll be able to see all the, oh, I didn't even notice that. And, oh, that's what that was about, and so on and so forth. So I really liked this particular episode to really bring me from a season two, like almost apologist to, no, actually season two is good. It's just not the same as season one. And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
I thought that it was very good, and it felt like you could just see all the last pieces falling into place as you were watching it. Like, you know, they worked out what the last shot was going to be, and then they just worked everything backwards through the season. So it was just that sort of like that last piece slotting into the jigsaw puzzle when Nate turns around, and it's like, you know, I could see what the picture was going to be anyway, but it was just satisfying to see that last piece going.
I feel sorry for anyone that's decided to, you know, throw a billionaire hissy fit and stop watching in episode two because it wasn't the story that they wanted, because this episode really is just so wonderful. The pacing, the plot, like the areas that they're choosing to jump between, everything of it was just absolutely incredible. And what a way to end an incredible season. But of course, we're not talking about the whole season, just this episode. That was really, really, really
wonderful.
No, I agree.
I just felt like I was nervous, you know, to watch it. And I was very happy when I finally, you know, did see it, that it was like, it pulled it together. It pulled it together really well. And it made the story arc of Nate really click, even, you know, as little as they covered with it necessarily, they made it, that final scene just makes it, you know, for me. And it's like, yes, the whole season makes sense. I'm looking forward to the next season. So that's what you want out of a final episode.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, there will be, as I said, an extra Football is Life, where a big panel is going to talk about the whole season. And there will be an Incomparable episode about it as well coming down in a few weeks. But it has been our honor and pleasure, all of us who form the, I don't know what, couple dozen people who have been on Football is Life for these these 22 episodes, to go through Ted Lasso week by week for 22 weeks, I think, now. So one more to go. I won't be hosting that one, but I think Chip will. And thanks for sticking with us and for watching Ted Lasso. And I just want to say one more time, thank you to my panelists, James Thompson.
You helped this panda become a better panda.
Casey Liss.
You know, I probably shouldn't admit this publicly, but really and truly, I'm just happy to be on the list.
Gene McDonald.
I'm just glad our run-ins are scheduled, because those normal sneak attacks catch me off guard.
And Kathy Campbell.
All right, scram, whistle, whistle.
And I'll just say, I've been Jason Snell. This has been Football is Life, and this is the end of this episode, only if you think of time as linear.